Boker Tov, everybody. Now we can, I guess, officially start, but welcome, class 101 in our series on the Siddur. But I just mentioned that where B'nai Noach and is large in B'nai Avram. So if anybody's interested, nobody has to be interested, but we were discussing before all this happened, but I started doing a podcast, like an 8-10 minute podcast on the Parsha. So if anybody wants to listen, they can. It goes up Friday morning at like 5 a.m. in the morning, I think. So we did last week Bereshit, this week Noach, and I talk a little bit about the relationship between Noach and Abraham. And Noach was an Ish Tzaddik. Noach was a great person. That's the Torah says so. And so whatever, it's important that the B'nai Noach and B'nai Abraham, hopefully the B'nai Yishmael and the B'nai Yitzchak can learn to work together. That would be great. Okay, we can start on the Siddur itself. So I guess with everything going on, last week I did something. I forgot to do something again, so I'll do it now. Maybe we can always do it at the beginning. I forgot to give a review. I don't know if anybody even noticed. But as soon as I ended the meeting, I said, oh my gosh, I forgot to do a review. I always, I feel review is very, very important, always in general for learning. And we know in memory research how much people forget if they don't review, and a little review helps a lot to maintain. So, and I always like to do the end of the class. So I'll do it now, even if we're a week late, or maybe we're reinforcing what we did last week. So very quickly, just what we discussed last week, I mentioned the Ramban, that everybody agrees that in an Eitz Sara, in a time of need, a time of war, that's what it says in the Torah, we gather the people together, we blow the Chatzotzrot, Bahareota, Mechatzotzrot, that then the Ramban, who says normally prayer is an act of kindness of God, that God allows us to approach him in prayer, says that in a time of great need, prayer becomes a biblical obligation, and presumably prayer with a minyan. Because the way the Torah describes it, you have to come together and blow the Chatzotzrot. So that means normally davening with a minyan is a nice thing to do, but it's not really an obligation to daven with a minyan. And according to the Ramban, it's not even an obligation to pray. So, but in a time of war, it's an obligation for the community to come together. And Baruch Hashem, you see a lot of that. That's hopefully is a good thing that will come out of this, the great unity that has been shown Jews in Israel, Jews outside of Israel, the care and concern. I got an email last week, UJA, UJA, which is very, very strong here, whatever, United Jewish Appeal, the Federation. So they sent it an email. They raised in 1 week $50 million. It's like unbelievable. 50 million, and they'd already sent over 10 million to Israel, and that was a week ago. I don't know, this week they'll probably send a new update, and whatever, that's tefillah, tshuva, utzdaka. Those are the three pillars. If we want to influence God, those are the three pillars that we have to do. Anyway, so that's just an important point always to keep in mind. We discussed belech lecha baderech, travel. How the difference between Shema and the Amidah, that Shema, you can still walking on the street and any way you want, Balechdecha Baderach, and the Amidah is you have to be at attention to very different modes of worshiping God. One is sort of a very natural one. As you go through your natural day, Balechdecha Baderach, we have to remember God is the king, and then we have the Amidah where we focus on the much more intently. So it's a very different approach to what we do. When we discuss the postures, according to Beit Shammai, when you say Shema in the morning, you have to stand. And according to Beit, and when you say Shema at night, you have to be lying down, like literally lying down and literally standing up. We don't follow that view, of course, but, and the Gemara, the Mishnah relates how Rabbi Tarfon did. And he was walking on the street and I said, look, I almost got killed. The Listim, the marauders, the pirates came and who knows, they robbed him, they wanted to kill him. Who knows what would have happened, but because I was so intent on following Beit Shammai, and the rabbis were not impressed. They basically said, Kedai lechu batmecha, you deserve to actually die. Don't be an idiot. You don't lie down on the road. I mean, and to follow Beit Shammai, that's not what we do. I find that comment is like so unbelievable. Anyways, okay, and then we started talking about how traveling, also the idea how travel opens up people's eyes, and you see so many things, and you travel, you see the different communities and different customs, and that's very good. That brings Jews together also. It's not good to always daven in the same shul, if I can say. I think it's nice. Go to shul, you know, every 6 months, or maybe more often, go every other Friday night. I don't know. Go to a shul that's very different than your own shul. If you daven in a, you know, a Young Israel, go to a Lakewood minyan 1 week, and then go to a Satmar minyan and a Hasidish minyan, and go to, I don't want, okay, go to a partnership minyan too. I'll throw in there that also. Expand your horizons a little bit. I think it's very important. And that's what, I don't know, that's not the simple pshat of Blacha Badarka, but that's really what it means. When we go in different places, we all know that. When you talk to people and you see other people, I just had a discussion this week. Somebody called me up, whatever. We had a long discussion. And one of the things he said to me, and I guess I can relate to this also in many ways, that he grew up in a traditional conservative family. Now he's more Orthodox, whatever. He's more, quote unquote, observant, whatever the term you want to use. But he said, so he totally understands that people can be very seriously about their Judaism, even if they're not Orthodox. They're very serious Reformed Jews and conservative Jews and secular Jews, all the people who fight for Israel. Who are we? In Chutzar, people who fight on the front lines. They're more religious than I am, for sure. And that's what, you know, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach famously said, the great Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that there's a minhag erev Rosh Hashanah to visit the graves of righteous people, kivrei tzaddikim. And he said, in general, everyone wanted to do with kivrei to visit the graves of the righteous. So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said he would go to Har Herzl to visit the graves of the 18 and 19 and 20 year olds, you know, soldiers who are buried there. Those are the kivrei tzaddikim. So you have Jews who are very dedicated, who aren't necessarily, who think like us, aren't Orthodox, and that's a very important point. That I think is always important, has always been important for the Jewish people, but it's always a point we have great difficulty in following. That's not the sort of, what can I tell you? That's our Achilles tendon, that our inability to get along with people who are very different. I can go on and on about this, and we have another time, but we won't. Okay, I just wanted to do a little bit of what I forgot to do the review last week, but let's pick up now. Okay, so we started talking about tefillin. So there's a, there, and we discussed last week, we spent quite a fair bit of time discussing why we discourage the Shulchan Aruch very strongly discourages, but doesn't forbid. And that's always very important. There's a big difference between discouraging and forbidding a woman to put on tefillin. And we said, really, we discourage men from putting on tefillin. But what can we do? The men are obligated to put on tefillin. So they have to put on tefillin a little bit. So we'll put on tefillin when they daven in the morning. But somebody who wants to put on tefillin all day, a man who wants to put on tefillin all day, unless we said, you're Rabbi Victor Nevensall, we don't go for that. It's the same thing. So since women aren't technically obligated, why start with tefillin? So that's okay. We discussed that last week. But let's pick up on some of the ideas on tefillin itself and the four parshiyot of the tefillin, etc. So somebody asked me, why do we put tefillin on our, well, I say our left hand, but of course it's our weaker hand. Of course, that, you know, are there any lefties here? Any lefties here? And two hands went up. Okay. And that's, not so many boxes are open. Maybe other hands went up. I can't see. So, may I ask how you took the lulav and etrog? You want to tell me how you took the lulav and etrog?
Lulav in my right hand anyway.
Even though you're a lefty.
I'm actually ambidextrous. I do different things with each
one. So you're ambidextrous, right. So that's actually a very interesting question. What do you do if you're a lefty? Do we take the lulav in the right hand because you're supposed to take the lulav in the right hand? The right is stronger, and that's why we have three. The right is always a symbol of more greater strength. So since the lulav is three of the four like species, that's the reason we put the lulav in the right hand and the etrog in the left hand. Also, I don't know if it's connected. The etrog is like the heart and the heart's on the left side. Maybe that's also true. So the question is, does that apply to a lefty? Maybe a lefty has to switch to that. I believe that's a machloket. So I had a roommate who was left-handed and he did it both ways. He did it twice, you know, once in the right hand, once in the left hand. Okay. That's okay. New lulav and etrog. It takes an extra 5 seconds, or you don't even have to take extra time. Just in halal, you know, switch your hands once or twice and you're fine. But, this comes up, of course, on tefillin a lot. How do you know you have to wear it on your left hand? So it says the way the rabbis derive it, shartam liyad al yadcha. You should wrap them on your hand. So the rabbis have a play on word. They say yad keha. the weaker hand, the weaker hand. So for most people, that's the left hand. And
Baba Yad Kai is usually spelled with a chaf sofid, but it was spelled at that time with a chaf.
Yeah. Well, it depends in which of the parshiot. I think in some of the parshiot, it's different. Correct. Right. So, Yad Keha, correct. It's as the extra letter, the weaker hand. So that's the halakha. If you're a lefty, you put tefillin on the right hand. Of course, so the question becomes, I have a good friend who's making a bar mitzvah, and he said that his son is a lefty, but he writes with his right hand. Everything else he does with his left hand. They get all these questions. Is writing the determining factor? That's what some say. Well, that's a big, it's a big to do. And like everything in Judaism, it's impossible to fulfill all opinions because we can't agree on anything halachically. That's, I say that in a semi-positive way. I mean, there is a certain, you know, niceness to that. Since there's machlokas, you can't fulfill every opinion. So I don't know that, I don't know what people, maybe there are people put on fill on both hands because they're, it's, you know, a debate, but yeah, it's, generally, I think the assumption is if you can write with your right hand, even if you do everything with your left hand, you would still put tefillin on the left hand. The question is, what if you write with your left hand, but do everything else with your right hand? That's not 100% clear. But anyways, Hedda, you have a question?
Yeah, I was just going to say, my rabbi stopped the service, as we were getting ready, with the lulav and esrog, and he said, everybody who's a lefty, put the lulav in your left hand. And it was so,
there you go.
And I wasn't used to that all my life. And I, we won't say how old
right.
I am.
So that's,
I'm a double senior. And I always used it in my right hand because that's the way my father taught me.
That's fine. That, as you hear, I just told you. So we have a debate in Jewish law what to do. Okay. And you should follow your custom. And if that's how your father taught you, that's great. And that's what you should do. I that's exactly why I asked. I wanted to see what different opinions. This is a debate in halakha. So, okay. And I don't think you have to do it with both hands, but with the lulav and etrog, it's very easy because it's, well, especially if you're holding it for, in halal, you have the lulav. All it takes for 1 second, you don't have to shake the lulav. We don't buy a lulav for a kid until he knows how to shake it, right? We discussed that a few weeks ago. The mitzvah of chinuch, to train people in mitzvot, is only when they're capable of being trained 100%. If they're only trained to do it partially, there's no point because we learn our bad habits. We do what we just continue what we're doing. So unless the kid knows exactly how to shake the etrog at Ana Shem Oshiana and Hodu, and he doesn't do God's name, what direction, we're not going to give it to him. Even though he could fulfill the mitzvah without shaking it properly, it seems like I don't want to say it's inappropriate. It seems like, no, the kid, the same way we tell a 11-year-old kid, you can't put on tefillin. You cannot put on tefillin. We don't allow you to put on tefillin because, you're not ready. Even at 13, you're not really ready. But okay, what can we do? At 12, when you're not ready, we don't want you to put on tefillin. So if you cannot do the mitzvah properly, it's better not to do it. That's why it's really, okay, I won't get into how far do you extend that by lulav and etrog. I don't know exactly what everybody gives their kids, the lulav and etrog, but I don't know. And maybe that's inappropriate, because you want kids to do, they have to do it properly in order to do it. You know, that's when you start the mitzvah of chinuch. But, all you have to do to fulfill the mitzvah is just to lift it up. You don't have to shake it off to do anything. Then you fulfill the basic mitzvah. So it's very easy with lulav to go to the left and right hand. It takes you a second and a half, but, it's interesting. But I don't know who your rabbi is and that, whatever. Is it a new rabbi in the shul and he came in like a new practice?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah, Hedda, I'm sorry.
He's been a long time, and he never mentioned it. I was never aware.
Oh, he never mentioned that. It was this year, all of a sudden.
All of a sudden, maybe because he's a lefty too. I don't know.
Okay.
It's also when we carry the Torah. One woman got very angry at me in the because I was holding it on the left, not this year, but in 20. So when we do it when we were dancing. I was dancing, but the women were sitting around the seniors. I said, I can hold it, but it was a smaller Torah. I saw her sitting there, and I said to the woman that was giving it to me, put it in my right side because I don't want her to say anything to me again.
Right, so
but I can hold it. I'm stronger now than I was.
I don't know. I don't know that there's any, maybe I just don't know, but I'm not aware of any idea that you have to hold the Sefer Torah over your right shoulder. That I, people do that, I think, because it's natural.
Because they're writing, yeah.
Right, most of but them. I don't think, they gave me hakba this week in shul on Thursday. Yesterday I got hakba. And I felt like, you don't give it to a lefty. You don't give a right-handed person hakba in Parshat Noach. You know, it wasn't so, and it really is. I'm telling you, it's the balance. It was for sure a little harder. I mean, thank nothing, you know, but I would prefer to get Vayikra. Okay, even in Sefer Dvarim, I can do Hagba. But in Sefer Bereshit, that's when you give all the lefties Hagba. But yeah, people carry the Sefer on the right shoulder. I'm not aware that there's any idea like that, that to carry a Sefer Torah over the right shoulder. I don't know. There's no real, I don't know. That's not, there's no mitzvah like to hold a Sefer Torah and, you know. Anyways, okay. So the question is, though, so how do you define the weaker hand? But why do we put tefillin on the weaker hand? That's the greater question. The true matter, I did not, I may have some more time, but I didn't find so much on this topic. In other words, what's the rationale for putting tefillin on the weaker hand? Does anybody want to, think what,
it's any? Closer to the heart.
Right. So that's, so that then, but that doesn't work if you're a lefty. So you're saying, okay, what can we do? The Torah is talking to 95% of the people who are righties. That could very well be. Yeah, yeah. It's closer to the heart. Okay. Some say, it's interesting. Some say, because if you put tefillin on your left hand, you have to tie with your right hand. And at the mitzvah is ukshartam. The mitzvah is not so much to wear tefillin, it's to tie the tefillin. And the truth is, that's when we tie the tefillin. Once you tie the tefillin, you can't talk to, you know, to put on both tefillin. So we want the kshartam, the yoda yadecha, to be with the right hand. That's a very interesting answer. I don't exactly, okay. That's what I saw some say. Others say the Kli Yakar, which I kind of like, he says that to demonstrate how weak human beings are, that we need sort of God to strengthen us. So we dafka put tefillin in where we're weak. This is where we need God to come and to help us. And I would also add, it reminds us that the areas where we are weak religiously are the weak areas we have to work on, right? Everybody, everybody has to do themselves. What are the areas they need to work on? So putting the tefillin on the weaker hand, so to speak, speaks to that. But it's interesting. There's not, I haven't seen a lot of discussion, just interesting people, but that's, and the, like I say, the Chazal derive it from the Yad Keha, your weaker hand, but that, of course, is what we all do at, we put on tefillin on our, quote unquote, on our weaker hand. Okay. Now, I want to go through a little bit, some of the points in the tefillin. So, just very simple question, but I know these are the type of things that often are not taught in schools, unfortunately enough. Why are there four parshiyot in the tefillin? Okay, so let's go. There are four parshiyot in the tefillin. Let's start at the beginning. So the four parshiyot are Shman Vaya Im Shamoa. So that's well known. And interesting, of course, those are the two parshiyot in the mezuzah. I don't know if we'll get to the mezuzah today, but, you have tefillin and mezuzah. And of course, mezuzah, obviously women are obligated. That's, for sure, of course. So the tefillin, I want to say the mezuzah is like half the tefillin, but, the mezuzah is Shema Vayam Shemoa. And then we add two parshiot from the end of Parshat Bo. Kadesh Diko Bechor, Vayaki Viacha, you should sanctify. We'll go through the parshiot in a minute, a little bit. We should, the two parshiot after we left Egypt, talking about the sanctification of the firstborn of animals, the firstborn of human beings, which is obviously a very, basic theme of the Exodus, and that, the firstborn have to have a special obligation because they were saved. And we know historically this, and we're reading Parshat Bereshit. Now we're going to start already next week. I mean, I guess you started already last week with Cain and Hevel, you know, like, the older and the younger, the book of Bereshit is basically fights about the brothers and who's going to be the brother to inherit, because the Bechor, the firstborn was a very important thing. We today in the societies we live in, we find this a little bit unusual. We are much more egalitarian, if I want to use that word. And even the halakha, I don't think anybody does, and I sure hope not. But I imagine nobody in this room has their will where their oldest son is getting double the other children in the family. I would really hope nobody does that. And even though it says so in the Torah. So it says so in the Torah. So already, this is not 20th century left-wing liberal orthodoxy. This is the Rama. This is standard. It was very understood that maybe in the society of the Torah, that made sense. The older brother was much different. But today, we don't live in that type of society. So hundreds of years ago already, the Rama talks about it. How do you get around the Torah? Just like, you know, quote unquote, how do we charge interest today? We can't live without interest and impossible to have a society to function. We'd all be poor if we didn't charge interest. The whole society function. The most important job in the United States usually is not the president. It's the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Setting interest rates is like the most important thing that gets done. The Torah forbids interest. So we're not going to, however, the rabbis understood the Torah has to be a Torah Chaim. So we can't ignore the Torah. So we have to figure out some legal way. So it's not interest. It's heteriska. It's a business partnership, whatever it is. So already the rabbis hundreds of years ago, sort of did away and they gave you recommendations. Most people, I have in my will, I have a certain clause that was put in. I had an observant lawyer do it to sort of, there is, according to most halakhic authorities, there is something you have to do to order to sort of get around, if I can use that word, the halakha. I think Rav Moshe Feinstein says you don't have to. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, dina d'machuta dina, a secular will is fine, you don't have to do anything. But most poskim don't agree with that. So you have to put in a clause, basically. This is not our topic now. But all I'm saying is we know how important the firstborn is in the Chumash. That's so much. Yosef, Egypt. That's why we went to Egypt, because of the fight zone, the firstborn. And so when we leave, so the Torah, so we, of course, have the pidgin aben. That's the main thing we have, but we don't really have so much, because even in the time of the Torah, the firstborn was taken away and given to the Kohanim. The firstborn basically lost their right to be the people to serve God, and that was transferred to the Kohanim. But anyway, that's the two parshiot in the Tefillin, Kadesh Li Vayaki Vecha, talk very much about the importance of the firstborn. Okay, we'll get there in one moment. Why these four parshiot? So these are
What's the fourth parshiot?
Shman Vayayim Shamoah. I'll show you in 1 second. Kadesh Li Kol Bechor Vayaki Vecha. It's in Shmot. Perek Yud Gimel. I'm gonna share the screen in a moment. I'll just quickly go through it. Shema Vayam Shema. We know we say it every day. So these are the four times that Tefillin are mentioned in the Torah. That's why they're in the Tefillin. That's a very simple reason. Four times the Torah mentions Tefillin. And as we'll see, the reason for Tefillin are different. The Tefillin, like many mitzvot, they have many meanings. So let's take a quick look at, the two parshiot, which I think, you know, I'm afraid to actually do something like this, but, you know, if you took a survey in your typical high school and maybe even in your typical shul and you ask people, what are the four parshiot in the tefillin? You're not going to get 100%. You're not going to get 90% either. Whatever people put on tefillin, they put on black boxes. They don't really know what's inside. And, you know, necessarily, and even if they learned it once, they forget and they, you know, but okay, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you get 98%, but I kind of doubt it. Okay, but let's take a quick look at the other parshiot here in the tefillin. Okay. Everybody can see. Okay. So we've just left Egypt. In chapter 12, we left Egypt. Hayom etam yotzim b'chodesh aviv. Okay, where are we? Here we go. Okay, so the end of chapter 12 is the leaving of Egypt. They did everything that God commanded, and very nice. And then here, this is what's in the tefillin now. By the very Shem Moshe Lord, kadesh li kol bachor, sanctify all the firstborn. Petar kol rechem, right, the opening of the womb. Badamu behebema, not just in animal, not just in humans, but in animals. That's a very fascinating idea that the firstborn animal, and by the way, there is a lot of halakhas. These halakhas we don't know of today, but the bechor, firstborn animal, has to be given to a kohen. And you have to redeem the firstborn of the donkeys even. And then why do we have to do this? Why do we have to sanctify the firstborn? So it's interesting. This is God speaks to Moshe. And then the next verse, Moshe then goes and speaks to the people. Like Moshe takes God's message and he just says, remember Egypt. Like that's not like, usually you don't have something like that. In other words, God says A and Moshe then says B, basically. Vayomer Moshe Elam, Zachor Te'yom, Asher Yitzatim Mitzrayim. Now, obviously the two are linked. Remember the day you left Egypt Ki b'chosek yerotzi Hashem, God took us out with the strong hand. Don't eat chametz. You're leaving in the springtime, freedom, spring, you know, agriculture. Pesach has to be in the spring. And then God is going to bring you to the land of Israel, the Kanani, Chiti, Amori, Chivi, Yebusi, right, that he promised you. And you're going to do this. This is not a one-time thing. This Pesach, you know, rigmarole that you went through this year, is not a one-time thing. It's everything. The simple meaning, that would include putting blood on the doorpost, but we know, obviously, we don't do that. But eating matzah, not eating chametz, and that's what Dora says, 7 days eat matzah, and then don't have any chametz. And then we have the Sheino Yodea Lisho, V'garat al-Bincha v'yom hazeh. This is the Garat al-Bincha. In other words, even ignorant Jews, even non-observant Jews, whatever, have to be part of the Jewish people. This is basically God's meant. You left Egypt. I took you out of Egypt. The firstborn have to have this special memory of Egypt. But I'm going to take the land of Israel. You're going to set up this nation and everybody has to participate. Even the Sheino Yishol. Ah, and then it should be a sign on your hand and a memory. The words are slightly different. It doesn't say Litotafot Beninecha Luzikaron. It should be a remembrance. Leman. Why do we put on tefillin? The mantia Torah Hashem b'ficha. So the Torah of God will be in your mouth. What's the Torah of God? So presumably, so Rashi says the Torah of God is Yitziat Mitzrayim. The word Torah in the Torah means a lot of different things depending on the context. You have to add all the korbanot. Zot Torah hachatat, zot Torah haola. Torah doesn't mean the way we say Torah means the five books of Moses or maybe the 24 books of Tanakh. But so the Torah Shem Epicha, the whole context is Egypt. So that's how Rashi says. Rashi says, if I could even show it to you maybe. Let's see, where are we going here? Why don't we? Here, I'll just. So see, I don't make this up. I hope I don't make this up. Vayalecha la'ot yitziat Mitzrayim. So the Exodus from Egypt. And al yacha and shetichtov parshat alalu. Write them down. The Torah doesn't exactly say that. You could explain it metaphorically. In other words, when the Torah says to remember Shabbos, so we, it's not like we don't walk around with the sign today. It's Shabbos. But here the Torah is a little bit more explicit. That's why it says it should be on your hand and it should be between your eyes. Then that's already different. It's not just remember. It tells you to remember on our hand, to remember on our head. And the Torah itself says it. You don't need really rushing. That because God took you out of Egypt with a strong hand, that's why you're putting on tefillin. So the first reason for tefillin in the Torah is about the Exodus. We wear tefillin to that's what it says in the Torah. Because God took us out with a strong hand. Also, notice the word lema'an. Lema'an. So this word lema'an appears by two other mitzvot. At least two, at least when the Bach talks about it, he mentions three. Maybe there's some he doesn't mention. But what are the three mitzvot that the word lema'an appears by?
Kibud av v'em.
Oh, that's one he doesn't mention. Right, Leman, you're right. What does it say by Kibud av v'em?
I'm guessing, on a Leman Yerbu.
Yeah, Leman Yerbu Yemecha.
Leman Yerbu
Yemecha. Leman Yerbu Yemecha. Very interesting. Okay, I have to think about it. Okay, that's good, right? That's why I knew I was opening myself. I said right away, I'm quoting from the Bach, okay? The Bai Chadash Rav Yo Circus, who is a commentary on the tour. He lived in Poland in the 16th century, the father-in-law of the Taz, of the Turei Zahav. They're both buried, I believe, in the back of the Ramashul. If you've been to Krakow, you know Krakow, the Ramashul. The Ramah came from a wealthy family. You should know, as I've mentioned before, almost every great rabbi until the 20th century came from a wealthy family. Because if you didn't come from a wealthy family, you couldn't sit and learn. And, you know, it's just the wealth. I mean, that's the way it was. That very few great rabbis came from not wealthy families. That's just something people are not aware of. It changed in the 20th century. That did change. And it changed partially because wealthy balabatim weren't interested in sons-in-law who were telling me they chachamim as the world changed. But whatever, the Ramah came from a very wealthy family. That's why the Ramah shul, the family built a shul. It's their own, like, I don't know, private shul, but, you know, it was a family shul. And, there's a family cemetery in the back of it, like Lahavdil, like how in the churches always put their cemeteries behind the church. We don't do that, but they do that in the Ramah Shul in Poland. So anyways, so the Bach, right, it comments on the tour, and the tour, we just had this on Sukkos. The tour says that we have a debate. Why do we sit in the sukkah? Do we sit in sukkahs in the desert? We sat in little flimsy huts in the desert? Or no, sukkahs is symbolic of the Ananei HaKavod, the clouds of glory. You realize those are two totally distinct sort of, is sukkahs like a yucky holiday you sit in some like crummy little hut? Or no, sukkah is the glory of God. They're two very different approaches to what a sukkah is, obviously. And the tour paskins, the tour rules, now we sit in the sukkah because of Ananei HaKavod. So the Bach says, what do you mean he rule? We say, who cares? What do you mean? We don't rule why we do a mitzvah. We do a mitzvah. There's no halacha. Why do we do this mitzvah? We have a debate. Which reason is valid? All reasons are valid. What are we talking about? So the Torah explains, the Bach explains, no, sukkah is different. It says the word leman. Leman yedu dorotechem ki besukot hoshafti. So that you shall know. Leman. So the Torah says, I have to know, why am I sitting in the sukkah? So I have to know. And if you don't know that, I don't know if it means you didn't fulfill the mitzvah at all, or you only partially fulfilled the mitzvah. I don't exactly, but your mitzvah is deficient and maybe non-existent if you don't know why you sit in the sukkah. That's why he has the rule that we sit in the sukkah, because it's Ananei HaKavod. And then the Bach says, we have this two other places by tzitzis. Lamantis guru vasitim akomitzvotai and by tefillin lamantia torat Hashem beficha. So you have to know when you put on tefillin why you're putting on. Here leman is you have to know when you do the kshartam and you tie your tefillin with the right on the left hand. You have to know the Exodus. God took us out. He saved the firstborn. So that word leman. So right, the Bach doesn't quote the man because it's you understand it's different. It's not telling us why we honor our parents. That's just saying, if we honor our parents, that word leman is a different, I think it says leman. I have to look it up.
No, it says leman. It's a different,
yeah, I thought it's a different, so. Yeah, yeah.
Meaning of the word.
Right. It's a different meaning. Yeah. It's a different application.
Like so that,
right. But, by the way, let's go back here. I think it says the word bavur. Does it say bavur here? Or, where does it say bavur? Yeah, bavur zeh, of course, bavur zeh. So, this is, of course, an extremely difficult verse to translate. It's very hard. What exactly does it mean? For the sake of this, God did this to me. What did he do? Big debates, not for now. That's by Pesach time. But I do want to point out the word bavur and biglal also. Bavur is for the purpose of. Biglal is the cause of. In other words, I think the rabbi said to me, it's biglal. Because of a silly coat, the Jews ended up in Egypt. You know, that's biglal. It's not bavur. We didn't go to Egypt for the sake of the coat. Bavur means for the sake of. For this purpose, God did this for me. So I can do the mitzvot. He took me out of Egypt right when I left Egypt. Okay. So that's the first parsha of tefillin. Kadesh li, Kol Bechor, it begins to sanctify the firstborn. It then moves on to leaving Egypt, going to the land of Israel. Everybody, including you have to teach your children, even if they don't know what the rabbis interpret that. The Sheino Yodei Lishol, got to eat matzah, and you got to tell, you're telling your kids about it. And then you got to put it on your hand, like mamish, like, you know, the same way, think of the Seder. We lift up the matzah. Matzah zu shanu aklim. Maror zeh shanu aklim. We lift it up. We do audio visual because it's much more impactful. So the same thing here, audio visual. You got to put on tefillin. You got to put on the yadkat. So it's interesting. This, of course, strengthens the question why it doesn't apply to women, because women are obligated in all the mitzvot that apply to the Exodus. They have to eat matzah. But that was last week's discussion. We're not going to go back to that. But that's conceptually the purpose of the tefillin. Then the Torah continues. It's kind of similar. And that's Parsha 1. You notice the pay. That means, of course, the end of the Parsha. And then the Torah, there's going to be blank spaces, and it's Ptucha, and of 9 blank spaces. Okay, then the Torah says, immediately afterwards, Vayaki Yivayacha, God will take, now, in the last parsha, we started leaving Egypt, going to Canaan. Now we're going to start going to Canaan, and then we're going to Egypt. Like we, the first one, we start from the past to the future. Now we're going to go from the future to the past. When God will bring you to the Eretz Canaan, and here the Torah doesn't say a Prizi Yevusi like it said before, just the Canaanites, you know, that's they're the lead nation. It's Eretz Canaan, but it doesn't, obviously, I think that's how the commentaries explain it. It's the same thing when it says over here, Canaani Chivi, Amori Chivi, it's all, it's not that, it's anything different. The Torah just didn't have to repeat all the countries. That's how the most commentaries explain. Again, Vavarta called Preta Rechem Lashem. You should give the opening of everything to womb to God. Nechoa Petra Chamor, this is a very strange halacha. A donkey, which is a non-kosher animal, you have to redeem it through a sheep. And if not, you have to arpato, you have to, the opposite of shrita, you have to chop it from the back of its neck. Of arpato, b'chor b'chor adam b'venachatipta. And then you have to redeem your oldest son. And then now we have the Tam. Well, we invite the Tam. The Tam says, oh, well, what's going on? Mazot, this doesn't make it. We're going to take a donkey and redeem the donkey. Mazot, what is this? What's this all about? And of course, we're not talking about Egypt, really. Egypt has not come up yet. You understand? Nothing has been said about Egypt. It says, when we come to the land of Canaan, this is what you should do. Nothing about Egypt. Mazot, what's this firstborn stuff? But Martalav, you say, ah. Oh, because God took us out of Egypt with the strong hand. That's why we do it. And Paro didn't want to let us go. And so God had to kill their firstborn. Whoa. So and you firstborns, you guys are lucky. Mibchor Adama, Bechor Beiman. God didn't just kill the firstborn of the meh, the humans. He killed the firstborns of the Amalek. Al-Kain, like in Kiddush. Therefore, Aniz Oveach Lashem, I'm going to sacrifice to God all the firstborn males. Just like the firstborn males were all killed. Ah. That's the yadka that Susan was talking about, the yad keha. This is the kape, the weak hand, right? See, before it said yadka, like the way we say it, yadka, your hand. But here the Torah writes it in this strange way, and that's how the rabbis learn yad keha, your weak hand. Ulototafot, not lizikarona, and totafot's also a very hard word to translate. How do they translate? A symbol. I think any commentary you're going to look is going to have a different thing. Okay. So again, why are we putting on tefillin? We're putting on tefillin pretty much, because we left Egypt. That's why we put on tefillin. Okay. Now, why do we put on tefillin in the Shema? You understand there's a, now we're going to come to the Shema, our parshas. I didn't even print it out. I assume everybody knows by heart. You have your Seder. I can do it. Why do we put on tefillin according to the first paragraph of the Shema?
As an oath.
No, it is an oath, but I don't know that we put it on to be an oath. In other words, what's it an oath for? In other words, the oath and tefillin, but these parshiyos, it's to remind us of the Egypt. It's the symbol of leaving Egypt. Which is very interesting. You know, ki bechozek yad. You understand? Bechozek yad, with a strong hand. So we have to put on tefillin on our weak hand to strengthen it. Like, it's actually fits in so beautifully. Ki bechozek yad otzi Hashem mimitzrayim. God took you out with a strong arm. I want you to, like, auto-visual that. You gotta everybody has to feel as if they left Egypt. Bechol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot atzmo. Ki ilu hu yatzam mimitzrayim. Everybody's gotta feel. So we go through the motions. Putting on tefillin every day. Remember, we have to remember the Exodus every single day. We remember it in various ways. But this is the most, like, wow. So we have to take God's strong hand. Okay, we're going to assume that's an anthropomorphism, although there were some who didn't assume that, but 99% of commentaries assume that, right? That and we, therefore, put on tefillin on our weak hand so we can be strengthened by God. So that's what we're doing. And, we'll get to the Einecha. Okay, I don't think there's a correspondence directly to Egypt, but we'll get to that in a little bit. Okay, so that's why we put on tefillin. In the first two times we put on tefillin to remember the Exodus, Egypt, God's strong arm. But why? And it's a sign. It is a sign. What's the sign of the tefillin in the Shema?
Not to remember to learn the Torah.
Right. So it's presumably Tola Korakula. Vishinantan Livanecha Vidibarta. Bayu at Vrema Ela. It's the Dvar Ma'ela. That's a, we have to do, the tefillin is for these things. What are these things? Avas Hashem, to love God. Why do we put it into, because we love God? Because God, maybe we love God because he took us out of Egypt, formed us into a great nation. And then we have, right, you have to love God. This should be on your heart, right? On your, and you should teach it to your Torah. We spoke many times. You should write it. You should wrap it on your hand. Tie it on your hand. So this is Kola Torah Kula. So that's how I think the Otsar Tefillah Siddur says, really, we can't, only the king. Only the king has to walk around with a Sefer Torah all day, right? The king, that's a special halacha. So that's like his tefillin. He's got extra tefillin, the whole Sefer Torah, but that's not realistic. So we'll only put on tefillin in those four places where the Torah specifically mentions the tefillin. But it's really going, it's not about Egypt. There's not one word about Egypt here. It's nothing to do with Egypt. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. I mean, it is the Torah, not so far from their Torah talk. This has nothing to do with Egypt. And it's about Torah in general. Okay, that's very nice. Then we have Bayam Shamoa. Why do we put on tefillin in the second paragraph of the Shema? Here I can, let me do that. Maybe I share my screen. Let's take a quick look here.
That we accept the idea of Schar V'Onesh.
Very good. Yeah. Why can't this is what happened here? Very good. Okay. There we go here. Yes. Very good. We accept the idea of Schar V'Onesh. Vayam Shamoa. This is all about reward and punishment. Sorry. Let me put it in English too. Vayam Shamoa. It's going to rain and you'll be good. V'chara other. If not, if you don't keep the Torah, God's going to get angry and it won't rain. Won't have water. It's hard how we applied this today. Today we don't, whatever. Okay, that's for another discussion that we sort of obviated that stick of God because we can produce our own water. We recycle water, which is fine. Just like God told Chava, you know, you're going to give birth in pain. We make it less painful if we can, but that's really, but anyways, that's how the Torah says. Okay, it's a metaphor. It could be other ways. Obviously, God can get angry. Or whatever, sure. And then with Santimet Raila, put this on your heart. Take this to heart. Take it to heart that actions have consequences. That the way we act is going to have, this is very hard for us because it's especially hard because we have no idea what they are and we consider it very terrible to ascribe, this is happening because God is angry about that. But the concept that our actions relate to God, that there's reward and punishment, that's what you have to put on your heart. And the way we put it on our heart and in our soul, like right, same idea is by tefillin. We skip the stuff of the Torah in the middle, like from the first paragraph. And then we talk about learning Torah. Notice what they did in the second paragraph of the Shema. They flipped the order. In other words, it should be right, that verk, and then ukshartam, but no, the Torah moved up, the Torah moved up tefillin much earlier, and, hold on, so tefillin is a symbol of, reward and punishment. So you see, very, very interesting. All you have to do is read the Chumash. Hold on. I'm just gonna mute people, sorry. Chumash is, gives us, just read the Chumash, and you see there are various reasons we put on tefillin. There may be are connected, but those are the four parshiyot of the tefillin. Okay. Any questions, comments? Okay. I don't know if that's good or bad.
Why is the order flipped?
Very good. You mean, why is the order flipped? You mean Rashi? Like, what do you mean by that? The Torah wants to put the tefillin directly with reward and punishment. In other words, it says you'll feel angry, and then we should teach that to our children. In the first paragraph, we're teaching Torah to our children, love of God. In other words, why did the Torah have to say v'shinantan levanecha v'limadatam b'neichem? It's repetitive, right? Both of them talk about teaching Torah.
Right.
See, first of all, the language is different. V'shinantam v'limadatam, and the rabbis derive, what do we learn from v'shinantam? Different ideas, right? It should be sharper, whatever we learn. But So the Torah is presenting Torah in different ways. Listen, life, everything's different ways. So there are different reasons. The tefillin has different meanings. Learning Torah has different meanings. There are different reasons we learn Torah. But here, the Torah, in the first paragraph, we're learning Torah as part of the mitzvah of loving God. That's what you get to love. That's what Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, that was one of his reasons. It's interesting. I don't know why only now in the 20th century, but when he talks about women and Torah, the great revolution of women learning Torah. So one of the things say why women have to learn Torah today more, you know, it's become very in, as it should be, because that's one of the ways we fulfill the mitzvah of loving God. Through Talmud Torah, it's a mitzvah to learn Torah, but it's also a means to the mitzvah to love God. And women are obligated to love God just as much as men are. So women have to learn Torah just like men. It's very interesting. But, that's the first paragraph of Shema, right? Right. We say to love God and then to teach your children. The second paragraph of Shema, we talk about reward and punishment. Put those tefillin on to remind yourself and then teach it all to your children. And then, but interesting, the mezuzah comes afterwards. And then uchtavtama mezuzah, in the second paragraph, they don't put tefillin and mezuzah together. They split it. It's tefillin teaching your children and mezuzah. The tefillin and mezuzah are divided. I actually have to look it up. I did not look it up. It's been a while since I've learned it because I didn't do kiddushin in Daf Yomi. But those who were learning Daf Yomi, so you learned it just a few weeks ago, where the Gemara has the whole discussion: why are women exempt from mitzvot aseishas mangrama? And there's maybe the Gemara is not 100% sure. Maybe women are obligated to put on tefillin. Whole discussion, and the Gemara is playing with the way the order of the psukim go. I just don't remember the whole discussion of the Gemara, but you know, because women are obligated in mezuzah, so maybe they should be obligated in tefillin too, you know, so whatever the case may be. But those are the four parshiot in tefillin. But
in what order are the parshiot in the tefillin?
So very good. So that was the next thing. Thank you very much. That's a famous debate between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. And I remember here, I'm going to show you, and who has this book? Anybody have this book at home? Reflections of the Rav. You see it? Okay. So Reflections of the Rav is, as far as I know, the first book printed with, besides the articles the Rav wrote in the 60s, and like in tradition, Confrontation, and of course, A Lonely Man of Faith, which is, now's the time of year to read it. Last week, A Lonely Man of Faith, but that was the Rav's own writing. This is the first book, as far as I know, in English that summarizes some of the writings of the Rav. And I came out in 1979, I believe, by Rabbi Abraham Besten, who was the founder of the JSS program, I believe, at YU for kids with weaker background. And it's like 20 articles, beautiful articles, the Rav probably gave a 4-hour drasha. And he doesn't do any of the halachic stuff. And he summarizes the non-halachic stuff in 4 or 5 pages. So he has an article, which comes first. What's the article? The article is, I tried to find it online, but I couldn't find it online. You have to buy it for $65 on Amazon. That's what it costs. It's crazy. Which comes first, God or people? So he discusses the Parah Duma and the Korban Pesach. You can't have the Korban Pesach without a Parah Duma. If a person is impure, they can't bring the Korban Pesach, whatever. And he's discussing, you know, that the purpose is the Pesach, but the Korban, the Parah is what is indispensable. And he talks about the different, the chok of the Torah, the different ways we come to appreciate and to worship God. Okay, that I didn't explain that well, but that's what the article is talking about, the relationship between the Korban Pesach and the Parah Aduma. That's what the article is based on. And from that article, and these are the articles of the commitment. One is the personal commitment, the Parah Aduma, the personal commitment that you have to have. And the Korban Pesach is our communal commitment. And then he takes that and he says, this is why he thinks, he wants to explain the debate between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. So just to say what is goes on. I assume nobody here puts on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. Anybody put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin? No. Yeah. Okay. Good.
My father. And
your father put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin?
Every morning. Yeah. He puts on both.
Right, I understand. Yeah, of course. Yeah. No, everybody puts, right. You can't put on Rabbeinu Tam without Rashi. I mean, you could, but you probably might not fulfill the mitzvah of tefillin. We assume that tefillin, of course, everybody asks a question, which I didn't look into now. What do they do before Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam? Okay, but let's leave that for now. But by the way, I saw it once. I think the Sfardim who do it, the real mitzvah of Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, I think they wear them at the same time.
No, Chabad wears it all the time.
I'm sorry?
All Chabadniks put on Rabbeinu Tam.
But not at the same time as Rashi.
No, they take off the...
right, but I've seen where somebody wears them both at the same time, like two head tefillins. It's pretty wild. They're small. They're that make them much smaller. You say all Chabadniks put on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin?
The real ones, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. They're not the Bali Chuba Chabads.
Yeah, they all do.
The FFLs. I don't know whatever they're called. Okay. So Rashi has them in order, the way we have it. By Kadesh Liko Bechor, Vayaki Viachashma, Vayam Shmo. The way the Torah writes it, it's one system. Rabbeinu Tam flips the Shma and Vayam Shmo. So you're filling here. So here's, Kadesh Liko Bechor, Vayaki Viacha, you read like this. And Shema Vayam Shmo, you read like this. It's like they meet in the middle. He flips. It's like 1, 2, 4, and 3, or really the way they write, it's 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, going the opposite ways. So the way Rav Soloveitchik explains the machloka between Rashi and that's the argument. Which is the Shema in the third of the four compartments or in the fourth of the four compartments? And then flip the Vayim Shema. That's the only argument. They just flip to the Parsha. That's Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi. So what's the argument? So the Rav explains like this, that Shema and Vayim Shemoa talk about personal commitment to mitzvot. We have to love God. We have to reward him. It's very Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Shebecha, God is our God. This is talking about the personal commitment to mitzvot. As we pointed out, and it's quite obvious, Kadesh Liko Bechor and Vayaki V'yacha are the communal responsibilities. Bringing in ignorant Jews in the Tam, it's forming a community in Israel. It's Jews coming together. And the Rav explains that Rabbeinu Tam says that, you know, there are two distinct, related, but two distinct commitments a Jew makes. We make a commitment on an individual level, and we make a commitment on a communal level. We're part of the Jewish people. This idea is greatly expressed, if you know the Gemara, when you come to convert. And the Rav is also, he doesn't mention it here in this article, but I know in other places. When you come to convert, what's the first thing we say to a convert? What's the first thing we say to a convert, according to the Gemara in Yevamos? I'm sorry.
Damn.
Okay, forget go. He says, how do we tell him to go away? He says, say like this, what do you want to convert? I should have shared the screen. Maybe if I have a minute, I'll do it afterwards. What are you out of your mind? Do you know the Jewish people are hated and despised? They got rockets thrown at them. People want to kill them. Hasn't stopped for the Holocaust. They want to perpetuate, God forbid, another one. The people hate us. They're anti-Semitism. And he says, Yodeani, I know. Ah, Mekabli no tom miyad. So the Gemara says, you immediately accept him. That's it. He's a candidate for conversion. He knows that Jews are hated and he wants to be Jewish. Wow. He identifies as a Jew. Mekabli, you immediately. And then you teach him. You teach him Shabbos. You teach him 6 mitzvot. The Gemara, I mean, maybe teach him more, but the Gemara lists only 6 mitzvot. What are the 6 mitzvot you teach a convert? Leket shichicha peyah. Beautiful. Staka. Maser ani. So leket shichicha peyah, it's obviously boring on the root story, the ideal convert, but it's also telling us, why did God choose Abraham? Staka umishpat, because God will do staka. So that's the primary function of a Jew, to do staka. So the first thing we teach a convert, the first 4 of the 6, the Gemara only mentions 6 specific mitzvot you teach him. Mitzvah kalot uchamura, maybe you add in more, but the Gemara specifically mentions leket shichicha peyah, the farmer has to give to the poor. Maser ani, that in years 3 and 6, you have to give an additional 10%. And Shabbos and Kashrut, that's it. That's it. That's all I mentioned. But we've already accepted him. Once he identifies as a Jew, we accept him. So that's what the Rav explains. There are 2 aspects to being a Jew. There's identifying as Jew, not religious. You're a secular Zionist. I'm going to build up the land of Israel. You eat pork on Yom Kippur, but you're committed to the Jewish people. That's nationhood. That's part of my commitment. The Yiddishkeit. We need both. Yeah, of course, Jews need both, but there's the national component and the personal component. That's what Gerim says. And that's how the Rav Soloveitchik explains. That's what the tefillin are. So the tefillin are divided between these two aspects. That's Rashi. That's Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi says, no, it's all one. You can't have one without the other. You can't have the national without the personal. Everything comes from Kabbalat Ol Mitzvah. You have to be Mekabel Ol Machut Shemayim. You have to accept the yoke of heaven. And that encompasses our personal and our communal commitment. You can't split these two commitments. It's a fascinating way to look at this argument. I think it's unbelievable. I'll read you here what he says here. Since I couldn't print it. By placing Knesset Yisrael commitment on the right and the mitzvah commitment on the left, Rabbeinu Tam emphasizes the two aspects of being Jewish. Each commitment has its own sequence. Support for the view of Rabbeinu Tam may perhaps be indicated by the requirement that a sheen be on either side of the tefillin shel rosh. What do these sheens situated in the Exodus and the Deuteronomy sides represent? Perhaps they allude to the two themes of the tefillin implicit in the system of Rabbeinu Tam. Rashi, however, subsumed both commitments under the overall Malchut Shemayim and regarded all the parshiyot as conveying one basic theme. He therefore ordained that they be arranged without any change in the sequence of their appearance in the Torah. The accepted halachic ruling has adopted the view of Rashi, signifying that Jewish nationalism and religious observance are inseparable and constitute a single entity. Both draw their strength from the overall commitment. I don't know if those are exactly Rav Soloveitchik's words or Rabbi Bessin's words, whatever. Very beautiful words. And that may be true, Rashi, but I will say, I think that the Jewish people have accepted Rabbeinu Tam. In other words, maybe on the halachic level, we accept Rashi, but we know that many, many Jews are committed to the nation without being committed to the religious observance. And we have the opposite too. Many Jews who are committed to religious observance, personal commitment to mitzvah, but don't feel an obligation to the rest of the Jewish people. Both of those are, of course, incomplete and incorrect. But I think it's true. I know Rashi is saying we follow Rashi in theory, but in practice, that's not what the Jewish people do. We do sort of split this nationalism, religion thing, but that's a very, I don't know. Anybody have any other explanations? Why?
Rabbi Jay, in the Shel Yad, how are they?
Oh, I was just thinking of that as I was talking about this. And this is actually really almost embarrassing. I assume that I don't know if Rabbeinu Tam switches the order in the Shel Yad. I don't know when they do in the Shel Yad, because this is on the show. I really don't know. I have to look it up. And I mean, I've never worn Rabbeinu Tam tefillin in my life, so I've only worn Rashi tefillin.
I'll just make one other comment about tefillin that I just learned yesterday from Rabbi Flansreich. He tells me that in Egyptian society, nobles wore scarabs on both their arm and their hands, and they wore them to ward off evil spirits. And he says it's not coincidental that Jews are not allowed to wear tefillin in a cemetery and at night when we're most concerned about evil spirits. And it's probably not coincidental that tefillin mitzvah occurs almost immediately after we leave Egypt.
Okay. Very nice. Yeah, that's the whole other realm, always looking at their historical context. Okay, yeah, very nice. Okay, I do have to stop now. I have to go teach in a couple minutes, but unlike last week, please go out there. Let's quickly review what we learned this week. Okay, so we discussed why we were filling on our weaker hands. And either we need God's help when we're weak, with the areas where we have to focus on, or we actually want to tie the tefillin with our strong hand. Then we have the whole discussion. What do you do if you're a lefty? Does it go by writing? But especially the interesting question on lulav, which is sort of an easier issue to solve, but it's just interesting. And we hear here the different customs. If you take the lulav, the right-handed, left-handed, if you're a Levi, and then we read basically spent the most year discussing the four parshiot that are put in the tefillin, and they're representing different reasons we put in the tefillin. The first two, really, we put them in tefillin because of the Exodus. And it's about when it begins with the firstborn. And the firstborn is obviously is connected to Egypt. And the same way God took us out with a strong arm, so we're going to put tefillin on our weak arm to strengthen our arm. We're going to take God's arm sort of with our arm to make it strong. And that's where we put on the tefillin. And as the Rav explains, that's are the nationalistic reasons for putting on tefillin. And then we have the reasons in the Shema and Vayam Shema. One is love of God. And it's all the Torah should really be in tefillin. Everything should be. Okay, we can't put everything. We put the four parshiot on the tefillin. Only the king has to have, of course, everything. And then Vayam Shema, we put on the tefillin because of reward and punishment to remind us. And the Torah flipped the order. They moved up tefillin. From where it appears in the first paragraph of the Shema. And then we discussed the debate between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, why they flipped the order. Shema Vayayim Shemos is Judaism one in the visible whole, or no? Listen, there are different aspects. Obviously, there are different aspects, but how do we view the mitzvot of tefillin? Okay, very quickly, Annie, you have your hand up. I think you want to ask a question.
I want to ask a question about the second paragraph, the last line of the Shema.
Okay.
After the mezuzot, it says, in order to prolong your days and the days of your children upon the ground that Hashem has sworn to your ancestors to give them. So that
right.
I figure that's the land of Israel, right? So
yeah.
is that a summary of all the things commanded in the paragraph, or is that only applying?
Okay,
right after
that's a great question. Let's talk about it, please, God, next week. Okay?
Okay,
let me just write it down.
Thank you.
The man Yerbu, is it on everything? What's going on? We can talk about that, just like we talked on Kivud Avim. We discussed the lemans. I forgot to mention that, right? The word leman means you have to know why you're doing it. So tefillin, tzitzis, and sukkah, you have to know why you do it, leman. So it's important. This guy, Zev, quickly, yes, what's your question, Zev?
There's one other difference between Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi. Are you aware of that?
Probably not.
it's where the hairs on the Shorosh come out. On which side of the boat?
Yeah, no, I'm not aware of that. You can send me. We can talk. I just don't know. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
thank you for
up.
That. I'm not up on Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. Okay.
The hairs are placed in front of a certain parsha, which changes position.
Yeah. Okay. Very nice. You'll send me that. We can talk about it. Okay. Thank you. Somebody just writing the question. Janine writing in the context of that evolution. I mentioned that. Yes. In that sense, women should wear tefillin. But we discussed last week why we generally think that's a bad idea. But there are always exceptions. Listen, I'm not ruling it. It's like when Norman Lamb was asked in the 70s, about women rabbis. He said, well, we're not ready for it. The community's orthodoxy is not ready for women rabbis. So the interviewer went crazy. What do you mean we're not ready? And they're like, we'll never. But he said, I don't know, maybe in 50 years, like maybe in 2023. It was, I think, 1973, this interview. Maybe in 50 years, it'll be a different world. And maybe women will be rabbis. And maybe women, there will be a time where women could come to. And we did have it. So it's not impossible that things can change, and we know of events in Jewish history, but it's generally frowned upon. But you're right, on a theoretical level, explaining there is some reason to include women in the mitzvot. Okay. All right, I think that's it. Both Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi be found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Obviously, yeah, it predates Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, but they're the ones who sort of formalized their opinions. Okay. Rabbi Liebtag will be back from Sunday broadcasting, please God, from Alon Shvud. I think it's amazing, all our Israeli teachers and teaching in the context. As a matter of fact, Shuli, I don't know if she mentioned on Wednesday, I wasn't there, that she wasn't planning to teach this week. She just emailed me that unfortunately she's not going to be she wasn't going to teach this week because she had some tour she had to do, but obviously that got canceled. So she wants to know if she can teach. And I think, of course, that's important. So I'll send out an email. So Shuli will be teaching her class this week. Rabbi Brody will also be teaching her Mishul, starting a new series. And I think there's one more new series we also have starting next week. We have three new series that are beginning next week. We'll send out all the emails, all the information, and we look forward. We should hear good news. Our learning should be a schut for the people in Israel, and we should hear good things and wish everybody. Thank you. Okay. Be well, everybody.
Rabbi, could you just tell me who last night's the name of the rabbi who?
David Harbader. David Harbader. It was very interesting talk last night.
He was so good. Could you bring him back?
Yeah, he just, okay. He emailed me. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
He was amazing. Thank you. Good Shabbos.
Okay. Good Shabbos.
Shabbat shalom.